A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today, we're tackling something I think we all feel pretty much constantly, cynicism.
Oh, yeah.
That feeling, you know, that instant eye roll when you hear a politician speak, or knowing deep down that some corporate promise is just hollow, or that sigh when you realize, again, that a system feels rigged.
It really is the background noise of modern life, isn't it? That sort of constant mistrust. But we're diving into Ansgar Allen's book, Cynicism, which is really sharp on this. He argues that this thing we often wear as a badge of honor, you know, our cynicism, it's actually a huge cultural issue.
Right. So our mission for you today is to unpack this paradox Allen puts front and center. Why is it that knowing so much about what's wrong with politics, with work, with, well, everything, why does that awareness so rarely lead to, like, actual change? We know things are messed up, but mostly we do nothing. Allen's take is that our criticism itself has been subtly twisted, hijacked almost, and in many ways, it actually turns into complicity. So this deep dive is your way to quickly grasp how our critical thinking got kind of corrupted.
And the key thing he reveals is this massive gap, right, between the original cynicism with a capital C, the radical philosophy, and the kind of passive, almost self-defeating attitude we see everywhere now.
Exactly. That difference is crucial.
Okay, so let's get to know the person making this case. Who is Ansgar Allen? Why him?
Well, Allen's a senior lecturer over at the University of Sheffield. His main areas are philosophy, education, and critical theory. And actually, his background in education is really important here. He's not just, you know, digging through ancient philosophical texts in a dusty library.
Right, that makes sense. So that mixed critical theory plus education means he's looking specifically at how power works inside institutions like schools, workplaces, government.
Precisely. And how people are sort of conditioned, maybe even taught to go along with things, even when they can see the rules are, I don't know, arbitrary or just plain unfair. Yeah, his earlier work, a book called Benign Violence, already showed he's really interested in systemic power, in questioning how institutions work or maybe don't work. So he's really well placed to connect these big philosophical ideas like ideology to what's actually happening on the ground.
So he's less a historian and more like a doctor diagnosing a cultural sickness, trying to figure out why we know so much but seem unable to act.
That's a great way to put it. He sees modern cynicism not as a sign we're smart, but as a symptom of a deeper problem, a crisis in our ability to commit to change.
Okay, let's dive into his main argument then. He's basically saying that our modern, everyday, small c, cynicism, it's actually a clever tool for social control.
Yeah.
And that it's a total corruption of the original active capital C cynicism from ancient Greece.
That's the core, yes. That distinction drives the whole book. And the central problem today, he calls it, enlightened false consciousness.
Hold on. Enlightened false consciousness. That sounds like, well, like putting two opposite things together. False consciousness usually means you don't know you're being tricked, right? And enlightened means you see things clearly.
Yeah.
How can you be both?
It's a bit of a mind bender, yeah. But what he means is you are fully aware. You see the contradictions, the hypocrisy, the bullshit, pardon my French. You see it all crystal clear.
Okay.
But you still participate in the system anyway. And that awareness, instead of sparking action, it kind of morphs into apathy and complicity. It becomes almost like a psychological shield.
Ah, so knowing the emperor has no clothes makes you feel smart, maybe morally superior.
Yeah.
But you keep quiet. Or maybe even bow along with everyone else.
Exactly. And by doing that, you neutralize your own potential to resist. That knowledge becomes an alibi for inaction.
Wow. Okay. So the book aims to contrast our kind of passive sneering negativity with the actual activism and truth-telling of someone like Diogenes.
Mm-hmm.
And asks if we can somehow get that original spirit back today.
That's the big question he leaves us with. And to get there, we need to go back to the source. Ancient cynicism. Capital C. This wasn't just an idea in your head. It was a full-on embodied way of life, a total commitment.
Right. This is where Diogenes of Sinope comes in, the famous dog-like philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient cynics basically threw out society's rulebook, things like wealth, property, reputation, because they saw them as, well, unnatural and corrupting. Their whole philosophy was a public performance of living radically authentically.
And they absolutely made it inconvenient for everyone around them. Diogenes, famously, owned basically nothing. He lived in a huge ceramic jar, a pithos, right out in the open in the Athenian marketplace.
Just living in a jar.
Yeah. And it wasn't just about being poor. It was voluntary poverty. It was an aggressive philosophical statement designed to make people uncomfortable, to provoke them.
That's incredible. And didn't he also carry a lit lamp around in broad daylight?
He did, claiming he was looking for an honest man. It's like philosophical performance art, right? Designed purely to show up the moral failings of Athens at the time.
So his life revolved around a couple of key principles.
Two main ones, yeah. First is parhesia, which isn't just saying what you think. It's fearless speech. It's an ethical duty, almost, to speak truth to power, no matter what happens to you.
Okay, fearless speech. Got it. And the second?
Autarkia, which means self-sufficiency. But it's deeper than just, you know, growing your own vegetables. It's about cultivating this genuine inner freedom that no external power, no king, no government, no social pressure can give you or take away.
And the ultimate example of both of these is that story with Alexander the Great.
Absolutely. It's legendary. Alexander, you know, the most powerful man in the known world at the time, comes up to Diogenes, who's just chilling in the sun. Alexander grandly asks if there's anything he can do for him, any wish he can grant.
And Diogenes.
His response is just perfect. Stand out of my light.
Incredible.
It's the ultimate rejection of power, status, everything Alexander represents. It shows that real freedom for Diogenes was internal. Thought and action were completely one. That's authentic cynicism.
Okay, so that's the peak, the radical commitment. Now, how did we get from that to where we are now? This great inversion, as Alan calls it, how did that active practice turn into just a passive attitude?
Well, over time, centuries, really, the philosophy got sort of cleaned up, tamed, it became more intellectualized, separating the doing from the thinking. We stopped living cynicism and just started, you know, thinking cynically. And that leads us straight to what Alan argues is the dominant way of thinking today. He uses ideas from thinkers like Sloterdijk and Ježek to explore this.
Right. He calls this cynical reason. Okay, but unpack that a bit. If we still have the critical thinking part, why don't we act? What does post-ideological consciousness actually mean for, you know, regular people?
It basically describes a world where we don't really buy into the big stories anymore, the grand ideologies, like, say, the inevitable triumph of capitalism or socialism or whatever. We see the flaws, but we keep acting according to the script anyway, maybe just out of habit or convenience.
So the modern cynic knows the system's broken, but they just keep showing up for work, paying taxes, playing the game.
Pretty much. They stay functionally integrated even while holding on to that critical knowledge. The intelligence is still there, but it gets kind of twisted inward.
Turned into a defense mechanism.
Exactly. It becomes what Alan calls a mechanism of disavowal. It's like, you know perfectly well that, say, some mandatory corporate team building exercise is total nonsense, fundamentally meaningless.
We've all been there.
But you act as if it is important. You go through the motions, you do these mental gymnastics to maintain your sense of being smarter than the system while still, you know, clocking in and participating. And that neutralization, that taking the sting out of the critique, that's the whole point. It keeps things stable.
Okay, let's make this concrete, because Alan really digs into how this works in specific places, like our jobs. He says modern cynicism isn't just an attitude, it's actually a tool of control.
Yeah, especially in the workplace. Think about typical office culture. All the irony, the sarcasm, the jokes around the water cooler. The endless complaining about bullshit jobs or some pointless new management initiative.
Right. That shared complaining, Alan argues, acts as a kind of psychological release valve.
Okay, so you vent, you feel better, you bond with colleagues because you're all in on the joke. You feel like you're being critical just by mocking the latest corporate buzzword.
Exactly. But the venting itself becomes the end point. It doesn't lead to organizing or demanding change or forming a union. It just lets off steam. It allows employees to feel critically engaged without ever actually challenging the basic structure of the job, the hierarchy, the work itself. The critique gets neutralized because everyone just accepts it as, oh, well, that's just how things are, or that's part of being an adult.
All right. But hang on a second. What if that cynical take is just realistic? I mean, if the political system really is deeply flawed, or if your job genuinely is meaningless in the grand scheme of things, isn't being sarcastic or disengaged maybe just a rational response rather than some kind of moral failing? And that's the absolute core of the challenge Alan throws down. He'd say that calling it realism is precisely how the status quo defends itself.
How so?
Well, think politically. If you believe they're all crooks anyway, or the whole system is rigged beyond repair, What's the logical outcome?
Yeah, don't bother voting or getting involved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It leads straight to political disengagement paralysis. And who benefits from that? The existing power structures. Resignation prevents any kind of organized opposition from ever getting off the ground.
Oh, cynicism effectively depoliticizes things. It makes structural problems, things that could potentially be changed, seem like inevitable facts of life or just flaws in human nature. If you can't change it, why try?
Precisely. And that's what Alan wants us to push back against.
Okay, so if that's the problem, what's the solution? How do we get out of this trap? Alan isn't suggesting we all go live in jars, presumably.
No, not literally. He calls for what he terms a cynicism of resistance. It's about moving beyond that enlightened false consciousness and taking on the challenge of developing what he calls practical hope.
Practical hope. I like the sound of that, it sounds like. Grounded optimism, a mix of seeing things clearly but still committing to act.
Yeah, it means holding on to that critical awareness, not becoming naive, but coupling it with a commitment to the possibility of change. It means trying to recapture the spirit of the ancient cynics.
Which was about integrating knowing and doing.
Right, and Alan suggests we need a kind of modern askosis.
Askosis. That's like discipline practice, training.
Exactly. Discipline resistance against all the social pressures pushing us towards conformity. Mm. You know, consumerism, chasing the next promotion, needing likes on social media. The idea is that practicing this kind of resistance strengthens your inner freedom, your autarkia, and sharpens your critical ability so they can lead to action, not just knowing.
So it's about finding ways to take small risks again, stepping outside the comfort zone of just knowing the truth.
That seems to be the path forward, he suggests. Moving beyond the comfort of truth knowing to the courage of truth telling and truth doing.
Okay, let's distill this down. What are the absolute core messages Alan wants you, the listener, to take away from this? The key themes.
Well, the first big one is definitely the paradox of enlightened complicity. That idea that your critical insight, when filtered through cynicism, can actually stop you from acting.
Right, the feeling of being in on the joke becomes an excuse.
Yeah. Ask yourself, does my knowledge about what's wrong just make me feel superior, or does it actually motivate me?
Mm.
If it's just substituting for commitment, Alan says that's complicity.
Okay, what's next?
The second is what you mentioned earlier, the depoliticization effect. How cynicism takes big systemic problems and makes them feel inevitable, natural, unchangeable.
Like, that's just human nature, or that's just how the world works.
Exactly. And Alan's implied counter to that is, if you're feeling overwhelmed by huge global issues, try focusing your action on one small, local, achievable thing. Bring it back into the realm of the political, the realm of what can be changed, even if it's tiny.
Make it actionable again. Good advice.
And the third. The third is really the call to action, the call for modern askosis. This is like our homework from the book. We need to consciously practice resisting social pressures.
Koso.
Ask yourself, what's one thing, maybe it's a status symbol I chase, a subscription I don't really need, an automatic habit like checking social media, what's one thing I can deliberately choose to do without, just for a week, say, to test that principle of inner freedom?
Hmm. Interesting exercise.
Alan suggests that kind of practice is what actually builds the muscle for critique and action.
It's clear Alan uses some really memorable phrases to make these distinctions stick. Let's share a few of those key ideas that really capture his argument.
Yeah, he does. This one nails the modern situation. Cynicism today is not the opposite of ideology, but its most refined form. It allows us to know very well what we are doing while continuing to do it anyway.
Wow. That's chilling, almost. It suggests modern power doesn't need to censor you. It just needs you to keep participating, even while you're criticizing.
Right. And then there's the core difference between then and now. The ancient cynics lived their philosophy. Contemporary cynics merely think it. And this difference makes all the difference.
That's that split again between knowing and doing. The critique stays safely inside your head, protecting you from any real risk.
And tied to that, this defining contrast. True cynicism requires the courage of truth-telling. False cynicism requires only the comfort of truth-knowing.
One changes the world, potentially. The other just makes you feel okay about the world staying the same. And Alan's point is that seeking that comfort is the real enemy of change.
Absolutely.
So practical stuff. How can you, listening right now, actually apply these ideas? How do we move from comfort to courage?
Well, one suggestion is to do a kind of personal audit. Next time you find yourself being ironic or sarcastic, especially in a group, just pause for a second. Ask yourself, is this negativity just a shield? Am I using it to avoid actually connecting with someone or to justify not taking action on something I care about?
That could be revealing. And what about at work?
Try a deliberate workplace shift. Instead of just joining the usual gossip circle complaining about how bad things are, could you practice a bit of modern parhesia?
Meaning,
could you formulate a principled, constructive objection or suggestion and actually voice it to someone who might be able to do something about it, even if it feels risky? That shift from just sneering with colleagues to making a genuine, reasoned attempt at change, that's where Alan thinks the potential lies.
Okay. And outside of work.
Think about your media consumption. We all do it, right? Scroll through news or social media thinking, oh, this is all biased, or this is so dumb, and feeling superior because we know it's flawed.
Yeah.
Alan would push back and say that cynical distance isn't actually a defense. It's still a form of engagement, just a passive one. So try to develop more active ways of dealing with information. Engage critically, yes, but don't let cynical detachment be your only response. Maybe limit exposure, or actively seek out counter-arguments.
That makes sense. For me, thinking through this, the thing that really surprised me was that core idea that our own critical thinking, the thing we're often proudest of, can be turned against us. It can make us more compliant, not less.
Yeah, it's counterintuitive.
And Alan really forces you to see that feeling discontent isn't an endpoint. It's a crossroads. It demands some kind of response, some kind of action, even if it's small.
Absolutely. And for me, the most valuable insight is definitely that call for practical hope. We have to stop using our intelligence as an excuse to sit on the sidelines.
Yeah.
Overcoming this modern cynical consciousness means we have to somehow stitch our critical awareness back together with taking risks, personal risks, social risks. As Alan implies, maybe the biggest waste of intelligence is seeing the truth clearly and then doing absolutely nothing about it.
It's definitely a challenging read, makes you look inward a bit uncomfortably. But ultimately, I think it offers some really valuable tools for trying to rebuild a sense of commitment in what feels like a deeply cynical time.
Agreed. It's a necessary challenge.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.